Alright, this is the Netzpolitik podcast. My name is Linus Neumann and I am here with Beatrice Busanice.
That's fine.
Who is a professor of social sciences and communication sciences, particularly in Buenos Aires. She is also a founding member of Wikimedia Argentina, a board member of Via Libre, which is an NGO dealing with the impact of information technology in Latin America, on Latin America. And she's preparing a master's degree on intellectual property at the Latin American Faculty of Social Sciences, which is called FLACSO.
Yes.
In Argentina.
Yes, that's it.
And the reason we're talking here is that she was an author, one of many authors of a book which was published by the Heinrich Böll Stiftung Germany, which is titled Copyleft Problems in Argentina. So that's what we're going to talk about, copyright problems in Argentina.
That's it. I would like to say that the book is also published, it's published in German and in Spanish as well. And that it's a pleasure to be here in Germany talking about these issues. We are here because this year Argentina is the guest of honor at the Frankfurt Book Fair. So we are trying to bring this discussion to the Frankfurt Book Fair, which is a very particular forum to bring this discussion because most of the editors industry will be there. So we want to talk to them about these issues.
So what exactly are the problems regarding copyright in Argentina? Because Argentina is often called to be one among the most problematic countries with the most restrictive copyright laws. Can you tell us about how exactly they are restrictive?
Well, this is not something we are saying, but something that we've seen in the last Consumers International report. At the beginning of the year, they published the IP survey. And in their ranking of the worst intellectual property laws in the whole world, Chile was the worst, had the worst. And then we had Brazil and Argentina within the 10 more restrictive copyright laws in the world. The other countries were also countries from Africa, from the South, from the developing world. And we have many reasons to be in this sad ranking because, for example, our intellectual property law, which is called intellectual property law, it's not a confusion. In fact, I don't like to talk about intellectual property when I'm referring to copyright. But our copyright law, the name of the law is intellectual property law.
I thought it was from 1933. Is that name still around? Was
yes.
It already around then?
I didn't yes, it was. It is from 1933, and it is still the same law with some patches, with some modifications. Most of them for the worst. So for more monopolies, more extend the copyright monopoly and also to extend the copyright scope. Like in 1998, they included software, which wasn't, of course, in the original version of the law. But we still have the same law from 1933, which is a really bad one because it is old, which doesn't mean it should be bad, but it cannot deal with all the digital stuff now. Mm. But for example, we are in this sad part of this ranking done by Consumers International because, for example, we are one of the only 21 countries all over the world that do not have librarians' limitations and exceptions to copyright. So almost everything a librarian does in his or her daily work, it's illegal. Every copy they make, it's illegal. They don't have the right to make copies or to share what they have with other librarians. Every copy they do every day is illegal. So we have no exceptions and limitations for that. We have just a few very ridiculous educational exceptions, and we have the exception for education environment is so ridiculous. It's they just allow you to sing a song in a school within a an activity directly referred to the program you are studying, and just if that is only for the school community for free, and you do not, for example, film or record that and spread that around.
So are you saying the singing?
The singing, or not, the reading, or something, or
representing.
So we're
not even talking about listening to the song, like a public.
This, but just within the school community.
Okay.
If you record that and spread it in your community radio, for example, or share it in a social network or whatever, that becomes illegal. You can't do that. We don't have fair use, for example. Fair use is something which is strange for our legislation, and we don't have any fair use clause, and we don't have private copies.
Let me get back to the singing stuff. So does that mean that if a teacher decides that a song is valuable to his class and he wants to talk about this song together with his class?
Yes, he can do that.
He can do that.
Yes.
But as soon as they sing it, or...
No, they can. They can sing it. They can perform it. They can do it within the school. Just for this purpose, for educational purpose. If they want to do a festival for maybe raising money for a trip or raising money for buying something for the school, which in Argentina happens all the time, that is illegal.
And this is a particular clause. This is one of the few exceptions that you have.
Yes.
All right. That's
so that this is exactly our situation. Almost everybody violates the law in Argentina. At least I don't know anybody who is not in a who doesn't violate this law in Argentina. I don't know anybody.
That's what I was going to ask next is if it's so restrictive, how do people deal with it? You just said you don't have the right to make a private copy.
No.
So basically, model of selling MP3 players to people is an illegal idea, or encourages them. Well, because usually you have to try to make a private copy.
Yes. Now we are facing a discussion regarding private copies and what the collective societies call the fair compensation because of these copies. So they want to charge a fee to all the digital devices, no matter what will you do with those devices after you buy them, but they want to charge a fee as a fair compensation for their losses for your private copies.
Who exactly is it who wants to charge that?
A fee, a canon, or
who's the fee going to go to exactly?
To the collective societies, to the authors' collective societies.
All right.
Which are the ones lobbying for that. Mm. So they want to add this private copy right, private copy exception, but they want to charge you for that. We think that this is pretty unfair because private actions are also protected by our constitutional rights. So I tend to discuss this topic from this constitutional perspective as private. It's privacy. It's something you do at home, and that makes no harm. So if they want to charge us for doing something which is private, they have to prove that we are really doing harm to them, which is impossible. We can't prove such a thing because we don't do any harm.
That's what I was going to say. So you're saying the informal situation is that basically everybody breaks the law.
Everybody, yes.
Oftentimes just for a sheer general need and not criminal energy.
Well, If you go, have you been to Argentina?
Unfortunately not.
Well, if you go there, you will see, as in many Latin American countries, it's the same situation in Ecuador, in Mexico, in Brazil, in Bolivia, everybody, that you will find people selling illegal copies everywhere. They are making their living by selling illegal copies, and that's pretty normal. You can buy illegal copies everywhere. And also, when we talk about private uses, so, for example, doing my own copies but not making a living from the copies, not everybody's copying. Everybody's using illegal software. Everybody's using it's using the peer-to-peer networks and downloading music, and it's pretty normal.
So
and
how is the law enforced then?
They do they enforce it just with the special cases. It's like they cannot bring all of us to jail. They cannot prosecute all of us. So they choose. And that's something. Sometimes I think that every time they choose someone, they help us putting this issue on the agenda. Because if this issue is not on the agenda and everybody's copying and nobody wants to discuss what's happening because they said, okay, but we are already copying. Mm. It's like, for example, let me put an example where a legal copy supports hegemonic, it's the word in Spanish.
Hegemonic,
the hegemonic model. For example, we know that Microsoft prefers illegal copies than free software. So if they enforce the law and they prosecute everybody using illegal software, in fact, they will be promoting free software because people will move. They will feel the need, the necessity to move to something else. And so that's why they are not enforcing all the time, because people will move to free software, which is the obvious thing to do. If they are pushing you, it is the obvious thing to do anyway. But if they push you, you will move to free software. So it's clear that Microsoft, also Bill Gates, already said that we prefer illegal copies than moving to something else
because it helps them maintain their position as market leader. On
of course. So sometimes this illegal situation supports the system because nobody feels that it is important to discuss this topic. So because they said, okay, we are already copying. Why do we need something like copyleft if we are already copying? So why should we care? But I think there are many reasons to care. Because every time they want to enforce the law, they pick up special cases, and we have these special cases, which are clearly unfair. I think.
Can you tell us about some of them?
Well, for example, we have the case of Horacio Potel, who also contributed to the book in German and in Spanish. So you can read the interview in the German book. Horacio Potel is a professor, like me, like every normal professor in a Latin American country. He's a philosophy professor, and when he discovered the internet in 97 or 98, when at the beginnings, he felt that this was an amazing world to share knowledge and to share information and to share his favorite philosophers. So he started with a website specially dedicated to Nietzsche. And then the second one was dedicated to Heidegger. And the third one, which was the one that brought many problems to him, was Jacques Derrida. You know, philosophy books in Argentina are quite expensive. And we don't have Spanish translations of everything.
Okay, so it was not available. Were the books anywhere available on the market?
Some yes, some not.
Okay.
But he translated interviews he found in French newspapers or French books, and he did the translations and published the translations. And so he did a lot of illegal stuff.
Did he do all the translations himself? Or
yes,
did he also copy somebody?
No, he did some of them. Then some of them he copied. He didn't pay any attention to the legal stuff.
Okay.
He didn't pay any attention. And so he did. He published pictures, translations, letters. He did translations, parts of books. He was so happy doing that. He felt that it was a huge contribution to philosophy in Latin America. He made no profit at all. No profit at all. There were no ads in his website. Nothing at all. And let me say something else regarding Horacio Potel's work, because Argentina and Mexico are, in fact, Mexico City and Buenos Aires. We have a lot of bookstores. We have a lot of libraries. We have a very, very proactive editors industry. We have a lot of books. But that's not the case in the rest of our country or in the rest of Latin America. So Horacio Potel had readers from Guatemala, from El Salvador, from Honduras, from Mexico, from all over Latin America. This website was a reference for everybody who studies philosophy or who just loves Jacques Derrida's work. And he was prosecuted. And he dealt with the court. And in the end, he was found not guilty because they couldn't prove that he made any damage to the editors. Of course, Jacques Derrida is already dead. But so there is no harm to the author. But
Nietzsche and Heidegger as well.
Yes, of course. but the prosecutions was because of Derrida. Mm. There was a French editor who started the prosecution. But it was a nightmare for him. It was a nightmare going to court with... In fact, it's a criminal court. It's not a civil or commercial or whatever. It's criminal court.
But were all charges dropped?
Yes.
So he was a free man before and after?
Yes. And Derrida in Spanish is already online.
Okay.
So but the case was very famous because it was a... It was a nightmare for him. He spent more than 1 year dealing with this criminal cause. He couldn't go out of the country. The police came to his place and took his computer and treat him like a criminal. And he did no harm.
Do you think that maybe his case was closed because the whole case had a lot of international attention?
I guess so.
Because, generally speaking, you know, of course he did break the law. He would have also broken the law in Germany, except I think for Nietzsche and
no, Nietzsche is
Heidegger
in public domain already.
Public domain,
I don't know Heidegger, but Nietzsche for sure.
Yeah,
is
Nietzsche
public
for sure.
Domain.
I'm not sure about Heidegger either, but so I don't know what would have happened to him in Germany. It probably wouldn't have been much better.
No, I don't know. But there was a lot of attention. There was also a lot of solidarity with him. Mm. The public universities in Argentina, we sent letters of solidarity with him. We really did a huge campaign regarding the case. And... in fact, my recommendation every time you have this kind of problem is go public.
Yeah.
Make it public as fast as possible. Make it public. Try to reach the biggest audience possible because the law is ridiculous.
So what would be other famous cases maybe that...
Famous like this, it's not the same case, but for example, there is another case also from people from the philosophy university, from the philosophy faculty in the University of Buenos Aires. It's interesting because there is a project called Bibliophil. It's the library from Filosofía and Letras, which is the faculty Filosofía y Letras in Spanish. And the students they built their own digital library with all the materials that they need to get their degree in philosophy, in literature, in anthropology, which is these are the careers they study there. And they did an amazing job. They really did a good work. In fact, I've seen many digital libraries done with a lot of money, very professional, and they are not so good as this one. You can find whatever you want, and it's really useful. It's really useful for the students, and it's made by the students and for the students. And of course, like in Portal's case, no non-profit at all. No ads, nobody getting money for that. No non-profit at all, just to deliver the students what they need to study, which every university student in Latin, in Argentina, as far as I know, is studying with photocopies. We cannot afford the price of the books. If we read a lot of books in a semester, you might be reading more than 10, 15 or 20 parts, yes, of course, chapters of different books. But if you have to buy them, you will end up each semester buying more than 10 books just to read a chapter, or whatever. But so everybody's using photocopies, and these students, they did it digital, and it was so useful. And of course, they received a cease and desist letter.
And what happened then? Did they shut it down?
Then they shut it down. They shut it down. And now it's again online, but abroad.
Yeah.
It's hosted somewhere else where they're trying to avoid a situation, but it's online again.
I have heard that in Germany, of course, you know, of course, there are people that own the rights in certain publications that are relevant for studying, and I've heard that sometimes universities themselves might put them online with a, you know, password protection,
yes,
so they're limited to the class.
Yes.
You just mentioned that you know, they were non-profit, so they basically shared non-profit, but of course the publishers or whoever has the rights in these publications might feel even more offended by that fact, right? Because they're not even selling it, they're not even making any money, they just particularly destroy the business model. And it's basically, they, to a publisher, might probably be considered a destructive act.
Let's try to see it from another perspective. All of these people, all of these students of philosophy, literature, anthropology, and, well, the same happens in my faculty, we love books. If we have the money, we buy the books. Every time I can afford it, I buy the book. So if I have to read one chapter, and then I discover that this chapter is amazing, and then I will go and buy the book. But that is possible now that I'm working and making a living. But these students, maybe they can't. But as soon as they have a salary, they will go and buy the book. Why don't... It is possible to think that these students are also promoters of the books. Because, let's be honest, nobody likes reading photocopies. And nobody... I'm old enough to not be used to read on digital. So I can't read a whole book on my computer screen. I can't.
I can't either.
So I don't like it. I like the book. I want to have the book and go with it. Maybe then we can talk about the e-books and these other new models. But these people, they it's not that they do it because they want to destroy others' business model or whatever. They just do it because they can't afford buying the books.
They have
if they can't, They will never do it. If you enforce this kind of law, what you will get is people excluded from knowledge, from the access to knowledge.
Yeah.
It's not that they will buy it. They can't. And the same happens. There is a researchers team in the University of Sao Paulo in Brazil that did a very interesting study where they compare the amount of money they need to buy all the books needed for the classical careers like law, medicine, engineer, or whatever, and compared to the income of the whole family. And that is amazing, because if you have to buy the books, I don't remember exactly the numbers. Research is online, it's available online. It's done by the KEPOPAI, the researchers group at the University of Sao Paulo, and they proved that they have to spend 90% of the whole family income
on the books of one son
to buy the books of one son for each semester.
For each.
So,
okay.
If you check those numbers, it's impossible. It's not that we don't like books. It's not that we don't want to buy books. We want to buy books, but it's simply not possible.
It's a common problem in sciences, isn't it? That it's particularly in studying. We notice it in Germany as well, that scientific literature, of course, is more expensive.
Yes.
And basically, in my opinion, the whole scientific process is held hostage by those publishing houses with magazines.
Yes.
That make universities pay for the magazines where the results that exact same university created with their money, so they have to pay to get their own results back, or to have access to their own results. I cannot understand how this will be a model that is sustainable.
In Argentina, it's even worse. I don't know how is the system here, but in Argentina, most of these research are being done with public money.
Yeah.
Because we have this, our university, at least the main ones, at least the ones I work and these students I mentioned, we are in a public university, paid by the state. So we pay the teachers, we pay the researchers a salary. They produce something which is supported with public money. And then the university has to buy those journals and the magazines, scientific magazines, and so to receive the results which
back.
They paid. But the other thing is that they cannot copy these journals. If they have the journal, they cannot photocopy it. So it is a lose-lose situation for public universities.
Well,
And there is something else I would like to address,
yeah,
which is also in the book. I think it's an interesting story, because a long time ago there were people in Argentina working for the university editorial called Eudeba, which is in a really, really terrible crisis right now. And there were many projects within the university, like the Centro Editor de America Latina and Eudeba, which are edition projects, with the concept of cheap books. So one of the slogans of these projects was a book for the price of a kilo of bread.
Yeah, you mentioned that yesterday.
And which is, I like this comparison, this parallel thing between books and bread, because it's like food. You need books. You need to write, to read. You need to learn. You need culture. You need access to knowledge. You need to participate in the cultural living of this society. And that is also a human right. That is also a human right. And we have to defend that human right. But these projects were closed. This CEDAL was closed, this Centro, Editor Center for Latin America was closed during last dictatorship. Mm-hmm. And Udeva is already open. It's yet open. It is open, but it's not working very well. The problem is that, for example, now the public university has an agreement with a collective society, and we are giving them public money to get the authorization to make photocopies for some parts of some books. But this is not a real collective society. It is an association that represents just a few editors, not all of them. So that doesn't protect the university from others suing the university. We are giving them a lot of money. And I'm thinking, why don't we use that money to produce cheaper books so people can actually buy books? So why don't we use that huge amount of money to think about new models? This model is not working. It's not working for students, not working for professors, and even not working for authors.
That's where I was trying to move on to the next field, the next important field of copyright, which is music. When we're talking books, usually there's very few people that make their living on the publication of books.
Very few. Let me say, in Argentina, just the most famous guys are making a living, and just a few of them, not all of them.
And usually their rights, the copyrights are usually held by publishing houses.
Yes.
So actually they don't, as you just said, act to the benefit of the authors or anybody except their own. So it should be a very small a portion of society that is interested in these laws, right?
Yes.
As you already said, everybody's breaking them. So, but what about music? Music, you always have to talk. When you talk copyright, sooner or later, you're going to talk about music. And then you always get this argument that the artists will starve once we abolish copyright. How about the situation nowadays in Argentina?
Well, in Argentina, musicians are already starving, even with this model. But well, it's with music, it is a complex situation because there is a big difference between the book in a photocopy or the book in a digital version and the book. The book itself is something we want to have. But when we are talking about music, we want a song, we want the album. And if it sounds well in your MP3, it is okay. Because most of the people don't care about these details, if it sounds perfect. It's you have the songs to go there with your headphones in the metro going. So in this case, it's hard to make a distinction between the legal copy and the illegal copy, because it has no sense. There is no value added to the legal copy. And I'm saying legal copy and not the original, because the legal copy is also a copy. So we are talking about copies. So I don't want to make this distinction between the original and the pirate version. That's something that I don't share. There are legal copies and illegal copies, which is... all of them are copies. So if the legal copy is exactly the same as the legal copy, well, then yes, musicians, not the musicians, but the music industry really have a problem. I think they have to start thinking about a new model. It's in Argentina, musicians are already using other models. Musicians are getting money from playing in public or by sponsorship and teaching, most of them, And that's it. They don't they really just there are just a few living from the royalties, from the author's rights royalties.
That's what I think is funny, because basically in the general debate, that's what copyleft activists tell musicians and labels here in Europe, and tell them, yeah, you know, well, once we're rid of all the copyright, you guys just have to think about different ways to earn money, and that would be, you know, live music or a special edition, you know, get back into the physical product business with merchandise or whatever. And that's the vision for a very low copyright situation. But how come it's also the same already in your country, where you have a very strict copyright situation?
Well, everybody's breaking the law, as always. We will find the most popular CDs in a street.
So would you say that the artists are starving because you are copying, or are the artists starving because of the labels?
Not at all. They are not starving because people copies. Not at all. They are starving because the music system is the music industry has a model which promotes just a few musicians. Mm. I think we have to think of this topic not only from the economic perspective, but also we have to think about the diversity perspective. Which are the musicians they promote, and why? And what kind of music do they sell? Didn't you notice that from a few decades ago, until now, we just have a few megastars, and then where are the other musicians? There are hundreds, thousands of musicians. And where is that diversity? If the music industry invests in megastars, which of course they do millions of profit, but it's a business model which is based on the star, on the mega star, on the Madonna, U2, the mega stars, and then they do promote this kind of business model, which
because
is
it's the optimization of their idea. Of course, you know, it's the best thing to have a mega star because you know you have the least cost and the maximum benefit because you can sell more copies with less money you need to invest.
If you look in Argentina, you have a few megastars also from national, from popular music in Argentina. But then you have, yesterday Julio Raffo in a presentation of the book mentioned that he's a fan of Harry Belafonte and he cannot find a CD or whatever. He can't buy it. And that's why. That is not because Harry Belafonte is a bad singer at all. It's because the industry is not interested in selling
that.
Him. And so you have to convince the music industry to sell you, and then you have to give them your blood, your everything you have. They are the real pirates here. They are the real pirates. As Julio told us yesterday, for example, they make you, if you're a new musician with a, well, you want to become a star, then you sign a contract, and then suddenly the your editor thinks, well, no, I won't publish him, but then you have a contract, and the contract is an exclusive one, so you cannot go and move to another editor, and then you are trapped there, and you cannot publish somewhere else, but they don't want to publish you because they don't see any possible profit with you. So I think we have to change the whole thing.
They can mute the artist.
Why musicians are starving in Argentina. Well, it's a complex situation because there are no places to play. There are a few places to play in public. There's also that in many cases they have to pay for playing, and it's a really complex situation, but I'm pretty sure that we are not guilty for that. we are not guilty for that at all.
As Tim Renner recently said on the at the All Together Now conference on music. He said music is not in a crisis at all. It's the business model that is in the crisis.
Exactly.
I think it's very important to keep that in mind.
And the other thing, I'm a free software activist. I come from the free software movement. That's why I'm interested in all these topics. And in the free software movement, we found a way to make a living using free software and developing free software, adapting free software, or whatever. But most of the free software programmers are really making a good living. They work. They earn a salary. They are independent and they work for someone who hires them for a project and whatever. But if you are starving, well, okay, go and find a job. Look for someone who wants to pay for what you have to offer. So if people do not want to pay for what you have to offer anymore, what will you do? It's just try something else. Start thinking. Don't go and ask, oh, okay, well, you want a different model? Give me the solution to all my problems. We don't have that solution. It's their business to find us. They have to find a solution.
So what are generally your goals for the future? You just said basically the main problem of Argentinian copyright laws is that there are too few exceptions, no real acceptable ones for education, for example. So what exactly are the goals that you are trying to achieve?
Well, we have different levels of goals. The short-term, mid-term, possible now goals, and what we want for the future.
Mm-hmm.
And they are different, but we can work in both scenarios together. In the meantime, we want to change our copyright law. That's our main goal. And we want to change other laws that are in somehow in cooperation with this very restrictive law. For example, there is a law in Argentina which is not the intellectual property law, which is a complementary law, which says that even if the author doesn't want to sue you, the editor could do it. Even if the author is against that, the editor has the same right as the author.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of books, these are complementary restrictive laws we have to deal with. So we want to change our law. We are promoting this debate. We will do it. We did this book in Spanish and in German,
mm-hmm.
As a tool to install this debate and to have something to go and talk to our legislators, the parliaments in Argentina, and say, okay, please read this book. This is a situation. And when you have a book, you can go and talk from a different perspective. So this book is a tool for this goal. As we want to change the law. We know that this is a global problem. And
yep.
The global problem has to do with WIPO, World Intellectual Property Organization, and with WTO, World Trade Organization. I had to think because I was thinking the name in Spanish. We know that we have to deal with the TRIPS Agreement, which says that, well, you have to respect Bern Convention, you have to use copyright with software, you have to have patents on fields of technology, you have blah, blah, blah. We know the kind of nightmare that TRIPS is.
Mm.
So we know that this is something much bigger than changing our law. But so our first goal, short-term or mid-term, short-term would be too optimistic, but midterm is changing our law. But in the end, we want to question the main foundations of this unfair system. And that requires a global movement to discuss this.
Yeah.
Global movement to push this agenda, to say, okay, we are copying and this is not a crime. We have the tools to share. We have the human right of access to cultural goods. We want to change the model from the basics.
One thing you said was that basically every case of strict enforcement of Argentinian copyright laws play into your hands. And maybe also, like you just said, as a free software activist, those examples play to your hands. Can you imagine maybe a future in which, you know, if nobody would try to use these laws or these protections anymore, you know, they would basically abolish themselves?
I hope so.
So well, by better example and in a better world, I could imagine you could maybe it might be possible to reach these goals without ever changing any laws, just by nobody taking advantage of them anymore.
But there is, well, of course, we are promoting free culture projects. The book also has, the book has a first part, which is a very critical part. It's a description of the situation. You will read articles from librarians in Argentina, from Horacio Potello also, from these students from philosophy also. So we are very critical with our legal environment. But in the second part of the book, we want to promote that there are other ways to deal with this.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we promote free culture projects like Wikipedia. We have a, I will not say strong, but it's an interesting Wikipedia community in Argentina. In fact, Wikimedia Argentina was the first official chapter in Spanish language recognized by the Wikimedia Foundation. We were the 10th official chapter recognized in the world. We
wow.
founded Wikimedia Argentina in 2007. We also did a Wikimania conference in 2009. So we have a very, very active Wikimedia movement, which is free culture, and which is a huge example, which is easy to share because everybody is using Wikipedia. So we can go to schools and help teachers. Okay, let's see how can we use Wikipedia at school. Let's see how can we use Wikipedia in different environments. But this is a very, very well-known project, and which is very helpful to promote, to spread the word.
To spread the word.
But we also have the free software community, which is another successful project. We can consider free software as a successful project in a copyleft world or in a free culture movement. But there are also musicians. For example, in Argentina, there is a project called Red Panal, which is a panal in Spanish means the bee's place, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And they are doing collaborative music with a CC BY license. Not even a sure, like a BY license, just more permissive license. We also have other projects. For example, we are now worried about all these cloud computing issues. And so we have a network with more than 100 free software users groups in the whole country working for a free infrastructure for our projects. So we have our own servers. We have our own infrastructure to work on, to guarantee that we control our technology. Based on free software, of course, and there's also free wireless networks like Buenos Aires Libre. They also have an article in the book. So we think we have to show these practical cases of different ways of dealing with technologies and with knowledge and with sharing knowledge. And I think the most important thing is to put it in concepts which are clear for everybody. Like, for example, concentration against diversity.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a key aspect of the whole discussion. Do we want diversity? Do we want decentralization? Or do we want concentration? Of course, big corporations want concentration so they can control the music industry, the film industry, the books industry, the media industry. We have a really interesting situation in Argentina right now dealing with our new audiovisual law, which is an interesting one. It's a really good one, even while I know that in Europe and in the United States, you receive news from the main newspapers in Argentina which are against this law. Because this law is against concentration. So, and we have a huge concentration in the media industry. And this is something we have to deal with too. In fact, if we want to pay attention to this discussion, we have to find new media, because the traditional media, the concentrated media, they are not paying any attention. They are just fine because they work as they have corporate alliances, you know, yeah, with the entertainment industry. So it's a big discussion around this. Well, that's the book has a very constructive perspective. So we want to build something different.
Now we said at the end of the podcast we would like to talk about a bit of the scope, because as you just said, you know, the problems you are describing here are not not unfamiliar to our listeners and readers, and as a friend of mine recently said, the internet is, on one hand, as you just explained it, the perfect medium for total freedom, but it is also the perfect medium for total control.
Yes.
And you mentioned the issue of e-books in that.
Yes, I think this, and that's why I'm particularly interested in going to the Frankfurt Book Fair, because all the new stuff, they will show all this new stuff, and they will be talking about this new business models, which is basically selling you nothing, because they will sell you a right to read a book, and they will keep control over your reading. If you buy a Kindle or an iPad, those machines are machines more designed to control what you do. And if we let them concentrate all this new trend on e-books, we will see more cases like the famous 1984 and George Orwell's case with the Kindle. You know, I guess all the readers of this blog might know about it. It was really famous. But if we just let them concentrate the whole market in the electronic books, we will see that, and I'm really scared that that will become normal. We don't have to let them make this kind of control as if it were normal. There are fundamental rights in reading we are about to lose if we don't pay attention. For example, the right to read in privacy, to being anonymous. In Argentina, maybe I'm a little bit paranoid, which is not bad at all in this environment, but maybe I'm a little paranoid because in Argentina we know how it is to live in a dictatorship. And guess what? Every time they went to someone's house, one of the first things they did, it was burning their libraries, burning books. They were many books forbidden during the last dictatorship in Argentina. So that's why we do defend, and we have to defend, the right to read anonymous, to stay anonymous when you're reading. It's just no one has to have a list of what you read. That's a fundamental right, the right to privacy. We have to defend that with these e-books from Kindle, for example.
Amazon or Apple.
Forget being anonymous. Forget it. Forgetting also choosing where will you buy your books. Because once you have the Kindle, you have to buy books for just one provider. Forget it. And then they will forget to lend the books. Reading is the social behavior. It's, I will recommend you a book. You will recommend me something. I will give you a book I liked. I will say, okay, Linus, read this. This is really good. Take it. Or then I will
give it
say...
Give it to the next person.
Yes. There is an interesting movement around freeing books and leaving books somewhere else and checking what's happening with the books that are being left in a bank, in a park. Or I think there is a movement doing that.
Yeah.
But this lending a book, or maybe I don't have enough space for all these books in my place, or I'm moving or whatever, and I want to put them in a box and give it to the school in my neighborhood or to the library in my neighborhood. That is also right. That is something good we can do with books. We can do that. We can't do that anymore with these e-books. We cannot lend. We cannot have privacy. And in the end, they will finish selling us, okay, you have the right to read it once. Then after you read the book, just
read the second time, it's half price.
it's the business model, it is changing.
Yeah.
In fact, it is changing. And we as readers, as lovers of books, we love culture, we love books, we love music. It's not that we want authors to die or we are the enemies. We are people who love culture. That's why we are involved in this discussion, because we love culture. So we have to be involved in this discussion. That's something else we ask in our book, because every time they are thinking about, well, new rules for the books industry, new rules for the authors law, new rules for whatever, they just don't pay attention to what we citizens, readers, librarians, professors, teachers, students, then common people, normal people have to say about that. We want to say something.
Yeah, most definitely. It's as you just said, e-books are going to be a problem. I just thought, just to make it clear for the listeners, e-books are not going to be the problem. The problem is the centralized business model of distribution.
Exactly.
Just
and the DRMs.
And the DRM.
I guess the listeners already know what it means.
Yeah, they should probably know what DRM
means. Okay.
just to add, as we've just said, the 1984 case on the Amazon Kindle was a remote deletion of ebooks of the novel 1984 by George Orwell that particularly students read in class, and that somebody had put on there who was not actually the right holder.
Yes.
So Amazon remote deleted them, and everybody who had bought 1984 and had the chapter marks and everything done woke up without the book on their Kindle anymore.
And that's a nightmare. If you think about this situation for a minute, if you think that they can control what you are reading, that's a nightmare. I don't want this.
Particularly with the background you just mentioned.
Yes.
And, but also this was, you know, this just illustrated the problems of centralization. So the other topic we were going to talk about was the decentralization.
Yes.
Well, okay, you know what I mean.
Yes, I know. I think all this fashion now regarding Web 2.0, which is a buzzword, I don't think I don't share this 2.0 web and that blah blah blah. I think it's blah 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 and just that. But these social networks, all these cloud computing trend we are watching now, it's changing this internet environment you mentioned as a tool for peers. We are changing this model, which is the origin. The origin of the internet into a more controlled environment, and there is no reason to keep using this server client model when we can use the peers model. There is no reason to centralize when we can do decentralized. We can do that, but if we don't think about it, it's pretty easy to go to the cloud. Then you have your Google Docs, and then you have your profile on Facebook. You meet all your old friends. You meet people you don't want to meet, but they are in Facebook and you want to see them or whatever. If you are not there, you will miss the meetings from your friends, or you will not exist. I'm not in Facebook. I won't be there.
Me neither.
I don't want to be there, and I'm still here existing. I exist.
I didn't know I miss out on that many meetings of my friends, but probably I do.
I don't think I'm missing anything, but suddenly we have this trend of millions of people giving all their privacy, all their information, all their data to a I've heard Evan Moglen last week, and he was so funny. He said there's millions of people giving all the privacy, all their data to a company, to a one single company ruled by a fool, which is plain truth. it's a stupid thing to do. It's really stupid thing to do. I don't mean to be aggressive with people that have a Facebook profile. I respect that decision, but please think about it. It's for a while, at least.
We can hope that the alternative diaspora might change a bit about this, but this trend to centralization is, of course, I certainly, I sometimes use the idea of the Web 2.0 because, of course, something has changed in the way people use it, but it hasn't changed a lot in terms of decentralization, which actually is this whole idea that is associated with Web 2.0. You know, you can leave a comment anywhere, but in the end, it's a comment on a Facebook pin wall or whatever they call it, and then it's not a web anymore, but it's a centralized thing, and we're giving power to people, and it's, as I argued for this diaspora approach, as you just said, it's totally unnecessary to have it all centralized. It's even it's just the best protection and more economic to have it decentralized. Yes. Now, the problem is, as far as I understood diaspora, everybody will be able or should be able to run their own diaspora server. Problem is, few people are going to do it.
Yes, and so everybody will stay in Facebook.
Well, maybe they will even switch over to diaspora, but they will join some commercial server providers who again have a couple of hundred thousand users on their system.
Yes. So yes, diaspora, and I know this is a pretty geeky thing, you know. So it's maybe we have to think about a decentralized model which would be accessible to everybody, easy to use, easy to install, easy to run.
That's what I was just going to say, because that seems to be the main problem. Of course, you can also buy an open ebook reader. Chances are, after a couple of classes in computer science, you might even be able to put a book on there. I mean, that is how Apple with the iPad, Amazon with the Kindle, Facebook with their whatever it is that they're doing, have customers, because they just provide ease of service. And it's always been the main problem in free software as well, that particularly, for example, GIMP cannot compete with Photoshop regarding the ease of use. And there's millions of examples.
Photoshop is not easy at all if you don't know how to use it. So the problem is that you learn this kind of thing, and then you have to learn something different, or forget what you've learned and try the other way. So
let me take a different example. even today in my Twitter timeline, I still read people that are complaining because they can't install Linux on their machine, which I thought was dealt with ever since Ubuntu at least, or maybe even in the 90s already by SUSE distributions. But of course, so what it requires is, and that's what the idea of decentralization requires is, and now I really don't know the English word, media competence. I don't know, maybe, you know, it's a competent, like to be...
Being competent to
deal with or to use whatever you're using here. You know, as long as consumers remain largely uneducated about what they're using there.
That's the problem.
And those are the two problems that go hand in hand, because I think if everybody was educated in the use or the function of the internet, you know, many people are not really aware of what the internet actually is.
Yes.
And what a computer is and what an operating system or a file is. And that is exactly, you know, there's two ways to address that, and that is to teach them.
Yes.
But nobody apparently feels responsible for that. Or to, you know, build computers that don't even have a keyboard anymore, that you can just tap, and that my 3-year-old neighbor is an expert in using. You know, he knows how to start apps. He can't really speak a sentence, but, well, he can speak a sentence, but yeah, he's able to use an iPad, which...
Yes.
Which is, so that's, I mean, that's an idea to address that as well,
yes.
To just make money off of the incompetence of people.
That's it. Well, the good news is that there's a lot of people working on this problem. Good news is that there's a lot of people aware of these problems, especially from the free software community, that we have experience on dealing with problems and try to solve them. And, for example, the Debian project is working now in what they call the Freedom Box, which is software to run on a small server. And the idea, the concept, is to have just one CD or a DVD, I don't know what is it, or maybe a pen drive, I actually don't know yet, but to install the software, and that automatically starts working with a social network, Diaspora, and then you can have telephone calls over voice, over IP, and all these kind of services you need from a small server, and where you just put the CD and it works. So it's easy. You don't have to install anything to find the dependencies and all the stuff, compile anything. You don't have to do any of that. You just have to install it and it works. And that's the objective, the goal. That's the what we want to do, to make it easy for people who actually don't know and who actually don't have interest in knowing more, because they just dedicate to something else. They just want the computer to as an instrument to do what they need, but not... For that people who are not interested or have no time to learn, and that they are not geeks. Because if you are talking to geeks, okay, they will have fun trying to solve this problem.
Mm.
And then, of course, they will find a way. But we have to think about the rest of the people. All that people that has never asked, well, but should I give all my data? I'm really surprised with all the people giving the geolocalization, saying everybody in public where they are every moment. I said, that is a nightmare. You cannot go publishing where you are in every moment. And they most of the people don't actually know that every time they tweet or they are... Well, hey, here I am, I'm here. That's a nightmare. That's a surveillance nightmare. And most of the people don't actually know that they can switch off that function. I don't know, in Twitter, I don't use Twitter, but on Identica, you can turn it off.
I think on Twitter, you also have to turn it on voluntarily. I suppose it doesn't do that for me.
when you see most of the people with that on, and then you think, well, do they really want this? Did they think about it before? We don't know. It's just like masses moving with the rest of the people and then going to Facebook, Twitter, and all this stuff, which is fashion now. I don't know here in Europe, but in Argentina, everybody's with this. Social networks and blah, blah, blah. I just want people to think about it.
Yeah, you just need the... Yeah, people just have to know. So apparently these are the two problems we're facing here.
Yes, apparently, yes.
And these are the two problems we're going to hope to solve on different...
At the end, it is a matter of freedom. I had to say it.
Yeah, it is. And I think...
I had to say it at the end. It is just a matter of freedom. It's not a matter of money, of how good a software is, how it's just a matter of fundamental freedoms. Not only the free software freedoms, but the fundamental freedoms. That's what is at stake here. And so, human rights, of course. But freedom.
Shall we make these the final words?
Yes, why not?
Okay.
I think they are good words for the final message. It's just a matter of freedom. We have to defend our freedom. If we don't, we will lose it.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Finito. Is finito right? No, it's not. It's probably it's Italian. No. It's Italian, huh?
Finito is Italian. Se fini is French, and se termino is it's not the finale.
Finale.